There's nobody here that's afraid of anyone or anybody or anything. We have no vested interest in a career in radio. So if we get thrown off the air, it's not going to bother us a bit. Therefore, we're not going to compromise what we say to stay on the air, irregardless of the pressure that may be put upon us.
So welcome back to the BCFM Politics Show, part two, where we look at international issues. In the second hour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is joining me. We will be reviewing Michael Moore's new film, Planet of the Humans, which looks at the environmental movement and how he alleges it's been hijacked. We look also at the almost unbelievable persecution of former Ambassador Craig Murray, who's being prosecuted for contempt of court for commenting and writing and blogging about the trial of Alex Salmond. He's an outspoken supporter also of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Also, Germany this week has banned Hezbollah, and the World Economic Forum has called to move the global economy away from the IMF and special drawing rights onto a Bitcoin-like blockchain system. Also, an emergency response exercise in Swindon has emerged this week that took place 4 days before the Salisbury Skripal incident with alleged Novichok 2 years ago. And last but by no means least, Donald Trump is doing his best to blame China for the COVID-19 virus. The question, though, is, will it wash? As part of our ongoing investigation into Nazi war criminals and collaboration with them by the Allies at the end of the Second World War, we look at the rise to power of Churchill's chum, war criminal and Nazi fugitive Martin Bormann. And you can compare photographs taken in 1944 and 1972. Is it him in Buenos Aires? And those photographs will be going up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I'm pleased to join Martin again. Martin, obviously the pandemic is the main news. We're going to be looking at some of the other things that have been going on this week. But I thought we'd start by having a listen to the Swedish epidemiologist, who's one of the main people who's been writing about all of this and actually making policy in Sweden. His name is Johan Giesecke, and he believes that there is no evidence whatsoever in Sweden of any reinfection, and that actually most of this is because the testing is not perfect, and it's quite possible that people were tested who had the virus, but it wasn't strong enough in their bodies. In other words, it wasn't enough of symptoms coming out that even though they had the virus, it didn't test positive. And then later the virus can develop, and then actually they get a positive test, and that makes it look as if they've been somehow reinfected. But anyway, let's have it start off, and we'll get your comments afterwards, by having a listen to Johan Giesecke, Swedish government epidemiologist.
The World Health Organization has said that there is no proof that the human body will have immunity to this disease, and indeed how long that immunity will last.
There will be immunity, that's clear. But the question is how long it will last. I think it will last over this outbreak, over this pandemic, I think.
Why do you think that?
Because it's a coronavirus, and we know about 6 other coronaviruses, and why would this be special?
But that's a big presumption that the World Health Organization are advising to be cautious against. They're telling governments be cautious about these antibody tests because there is no evidence to prove how much immunity or how long immunity will last.
I think they're wrong there. But I agree. We don't know. We can just presume, like you said.
So what you're doing is taking a gamble rather than taking the safer route, which is to lock down your community. Why is that not safer?
There hasn't been any proven case of anyone getting a second time corona infection. If you had it once, you don't get it second. I mean, I admit the time is short, and that may change. But so far, there has been no reinfections observed.
So, Martin, that is we just heard there on BBC Five Live with Stephen Nolan, Johan Giesecke, who's a Swedish government's epidemiologist, saying, as far as they're concerned, they've seen no evidence of this reinfection. And therefore, what they're planning to do is to allow the less vulnerable in Sweden to catch the virus. And that big advantage of that, of course, is that once they reopen, they have a very limited lockdown at the moment. But once they open things up more, they are saying that this is going to protect them against a second wave, because the disease won't be able to spread, because over 50% of the population, the mostly younger people, less vulnerable, won't be able to catch it a second time.
Well, I'm not a epidemiologist, so I listen to what everybody says and I try and assess what they seem to be saying. He seems to be saying a priori that there won't be reinfections, which would be normal for things like flu, for example. But of course, the WHO are saying, well, hang on a minute, we don't know that there are no reinfections. Now, the only answer to this, of course, is to suck it and see. And it may be the case that they're making the right call in Sweden. But of course, we've deliberately turned our back on this in this country. We've decided we're not going for herd immunity. We're going to trace people because it's not clear that herd immunity can be achieved. Now, that makes the British government's policy completely wrong if it's going to have lockdown plus testing, which is what we've decided to do. Although initially we decided to go for, we're going to get herd immunity. Although the government here is now denying that they ever said they wanted to get herd immunity.
It
gives the impression that they don't care if people die.
I don't think there is any point in that, because most of us can remember Boris Johnson's speech. In fact, you can find it on YouTube, I'm sure, where he says that that's exactly what they're going to do. Try for herd immunity, and then they changed their mind because
that's
of this
right. This
report that came out warning of 500,000 deaths in Britain, and that was by Imperial College, Neil Ferguson there, which just so happens to be sponsored to the tune of tens of millions of pounds by the Gates Foundation. But look, anyway, let's go on to look at what I mean. It's quite feasible that the COVID-19 coronavirus was widespread in Britain right at the very beginning of the outbreak. We're talking about at the end of December and January. So that's December 2019 and January 2020. There's a study by Oxford University that suggests that this is the case. Anecdotally, I had personally had a very, very strong, horrendous flu that kept me in bed for 3.5 days, dosed up with aspirin and paracetamol, and then 2 weeks afterwards of this dry cough. And so I'm wondering whether it is. Anyway, that possibility has been given an enormous boost this week from Iceland, because the Icelandic Decode Genetics company, which has been doing a lot of surveillance of all of the people in Iceland that have caught it. Obviously, this is a lot easier to do in Iceland as it's a smaller country. Carrie Stephenson was speaking to Sky News earlier this week, and he also suggests that the initial very, very start of the pandemic, the initial infections in Iceland were coming from, number one, from the Alps, and number two, from the UK.
We have done more than screen for the virus. We have sequenced the virus from every individual infected in Iceland. So the virus has now basically a barcode for every part of the world. In the beginning, almost all of the cases came into the country from the Alps. And as the authorities were trying to contain the spread of the infection, the virus was sneaking in. And the most notable there is Great Britain. So it looks like the virus had a fairly widespread in Great Britain very, very early in this epidemic. There are those who describe this as a mild cold. There are those who end up in the intensive care unit on a respirator, and then you have everything in between. We know that women have less tendency to get infected than men, and if they get infected, they don't get as sick as men. I mean, what is it that generates this clinical diversity?
Kerry Stephenson rejects the notion it's been easier for a small nation to manage the virus.
Yes, we may be fewer of us, you know, but the countries like the United Kingdom and the United States have so much, much more resources than we do. It is all a question of just using what you have. They weren't vigilant enough. They didn't react to this early enough. You know, the countries that taught us the methods that we are using in doing this, in a place like Iceland, they didn't use it themselves, and that is tragic.
So that's Kerry Stephenson from the company Decode Genetics speaking on Sky News this week about the fact that what they're doing, Martin, over in Iceland is using techniques which were developed in the United States and Britain for sequencing genomes of the virus and keeping track of it. And yet the British and the Americans have not used these techniques. And he's saying this is a tragedy because it means that they're not actually dealing with the virus, which they developed the techniques to deal with.
Well, I think there are going to be very serious questions about the leadership in both the US and the United Kingdom over this. I think I refer to them as the Trump is reckless and Boris is feckless. And that is definitely going to, they're both of them facing the biggest challenges of their political careers for basically not doing the basic stuff which the Icelanders have done. And of course, the Icelanders did the right stuff when it then in terms of dealing with the banking crisis in 2008. So they've got a record of doing the right thing. They sent their bankers to jail and they renationalized the banks. But it doesn't surprise me that Britain has become a focal point for the virus. And also what's interesting is how quickly it came to Britain. And it may well be that the source of the virus is not, in fact, in China at all. And there's all sorts of rumours swirling around about that, including...
But it's not just rumours, is it? Because Donald Trump this week has done his best to pin the origin of the virus on the virology lab in Wuhan.
Yeah. Well, of course, and of course, that virology lab had contracts with the US government to investigate bat coronaviruses. So, in other words, the US government is itself involved in that particular laboratory. And of course, there's a Cambridge.
Can I just interrupt you just quickly? Because I know Nature magazine last year were raising all sorts of issues about that, saying this is really dangerous research they're doing here. Because if one of these viruses mutates that they're playing with, it could cause an enormous outbreak.
Well, in actual fact, there are hundreds of biological warfare labs scattered around the world outside the United States, but run by the Pentagon, which are experimenting with biological weaponry. And they've used biological weaponry in Korea in the 1950s and in Cuba in the 1960s and 1970s. So the idea that these biolaboratories are dangerous is absolutely correct. They are. Now, the question is, did it come from that particular lab? And of course, the mainstream are saying, no, the evidence shows that it's a natural virus, although others are out there saying, no, it looks as if it might have been tampered with, or in any case, it might have been taken from the lab, even if it hadn't been tampered with, if you follow my logic. Now, obviously, the US government is looking now to pin the blame on China because they want to cancel all the debt that China owes, the national debt that China is holding. So they're going to try and use the courts, as they did against Argentina, to try and sue the Chinese government for losses in the US, which basically means you're going to a full-on trade war with the Chinese.
I mean, Martin, what you're suggesting here is that the Americans have borrowed tremendous amounts of money from China, and they're going to use this, or you're suggesting that Trump wants to use this as an excuse not to pay them back.
Yeah, I mean, basically the Chinese have been exporting to the US over the last 20, 30 years, and they've been paid in, they've recycled the money that they've earned into US treasuries, which basically props up the US government. But the US government could just turn around and say, we're not going to pay that. But of course, that will then have implications for the US dollar's role as the linchpin of an international financial system. So all of this kind of tsunami of financial and military news is being obscured, really, by all the discussion about the virus and its mutation and so on. But anyway, there's a Cambridge University study that shows that the virus probably didn't come from Wuhan, but possibly from southern China. So there's another trail leading in that direction. But of course, if it's been much more widely spread for a much longer period, then it may well be that the Wuhan virus, the Americans call the Wuhan virus, of course, the Chinese already pointed out that the US military were in Wuhan just before all of this broke. Because of the military games that took place. And several of the people who participated in the military games were, in fact, hospitalized in Wuhan for fever. Now, all of this background then leads us further back to the possibility that Fort Detrick may have been the source of this, if it is a biolab virus, and that it's been spreading from the US into China and into the UK. And it was only when the Chinese picked up on it that suddenly it became recognised for what it was. Now, that could be either accidental or deliberate by the deep state in the US. But you've got to remember the track record of the deep state in the US is that the stock market was collapsing anyway in September. It was going down the drain. And what the coronavirus crisis has allowed the deep state in the US to do is to bail out the banking system and the big corporations in the US with billions of dollars of made up money, which ultimately would be landed on the backs of the taxpayer. And of course, everybody's accepting this as a good thing to do, like Rishi Sunak here, just writing blank checks to everybody. Everybody's going, hooray, isn't this marvellous? If there hadn't been a coronavirus, we'd all be going, what the hell's going on?
He hasn't written one to me, Martin, I can tell
you. Well, no, this is the point, isn't it? So everybody is allowing all of this, what is essentially a heist on the financial system, to go ahead because it's being presented to everybody as an emergency measure to deal with the coronavirus crisis.
Well, now, that
gives you a motivation for the US deep state to attack China in this way. So, of course, it also ruins China's Belt and Road Initiative. They can't build any of the infrastructure that they wanted to do. They can't take the lead in the developing world, which they hope to do. They're going to have real problems keeping their own people employed. And, of course, there's no proper unemployment benefits in China. If you get mass unemployment in China, which you're probably going to get, you could get unrest, which could lead to the overthrow of the government. You can see how the mindset in the US might lead in that direction. But in any case, whether they did it or not, the US deep state, Pompeo and all the others, are determined to use this as a means to attack China, Iran, Venezuela, and the North Korea. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And therefore, what we're looking at here is a scenario for World War III with the coronavirus as basically just the first opening shot.
Okay, what about the World Economic Forum this week? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Mark Carney had been calling for some kind of cryptocurrency last year. I think it was around about September. There's a really good Guardian article about that. But now World Economic Forum 2 is saying that what we need to replace the old IMF, the special drawing rights and the old financial architecture, is some kind of Bitcoin-like blockchain system.
Well, I mean, the Venezuelans are trying to develop their own cryptocurrencies because they're trying to get out of the existing financial structure, which gives extraordinary power to the US dollar. Now, we could envisage a change in the financial architecture, but I cannot see that the US are going to give up the dollar as the linchpin, especially at the moment, because the dollar is strong and all the countries in the developing world, all of them, without exception, are now in terrible situation, and they're going to the IMF begging for loans to roll their debts over to the private sector. And both the Iranians and the Venezuelans have even applied for IMF funding. And you'd have thought that they would only do that if they were desperate. But of course, they've been told they can't have it. And there's a very good article on the Saker blog which points out that this the massive money printing by the Federal Reserve, they're basically bailing out the whole world's economy. They've become the central bank for the world. It's not in their articles of association. They're supposed to be the US central bank, but they've basically become the world's central bank. And they've bailed out the people they want to bail out. They've subcontracted to BlackRock, which is a private hedge fund, to decide who gets bailed out. And of course, BlackRock themselves get bailed out. And basically, they can crush anybody they don't like. So, for example, Airbus will not get bailed out because the Yanks don't like it. Zimbabwe will not be bailed out.
And maybe Boeing will.
Well, exactly. And nobody will know who's made, because the decisions about who gets bailed out and who doesn't get bailed out are, guess this, commercially confidential. So we don't know who gets bailed out. The same thing happened with the TARP bailout in 2008. And so, in other words, what's really going on behind all of this, it's a kind of a Wizard of Oz kind of scenario where we're all running around wondering whether what the virus is doing, where it came from and all the rest of it. Meanwhile, under cover of that, a massive power play is being carried through. And all of the developing world are caught in the trap because there are lots of money. But the money that was being printed through quantitative easing all went into places like Brazil to bid up local asset values there. But as soon as the crisis comes, all that money goes zooming out. It's hot money. So it comes in and it goes out. And then, of course, you're left completely dependent on the IMF again, which is run by the Americans. They have they decide that the Venezuelans and the Iranians can't have any money because the IMF is basically their debt collector. It's the repo man. And I think the idea that some kind of international currency will develop beyond the dollar is missing the political points here. Keynes in the 1940s talked about having an international currency called Bancor, which wouldn't be controlled by any individual government. It would be a neutral currency to allow the international system to function. But the Americans shot that down straight away because they realised that if there was an international currency which they didn't control, then they wouldn't control it. So that's why we've got the infrastructure we've got now, which is based on the dollar, because they do control that. There are attempts to try and build a different financial architecture. The Chinese and the Russians, for example, have been buying gold. They've been trying to make their currencies hard currencies. They're trying to do deals with each other which don't involve using the dollar. But we're still a long way away from the dollar losing its reserve currency status. And, of course, this allows the US to manipulate everybody, which is exactly what they – I mean, this is, Trump is pretty clear about what he wants to do. He wants to bankrupt everybody else so that the elite in the US can profit.
Now, WikiLeaks has done a big dump this week of more and more data. One does wonder whether there's a sense amongst Assange and his colleagues – that as it moves closer and closer to the extradition of Assange to the United States, that more and more the best way to deal with that is to make sure that there is no information left to leak when that happens. But
I mean, we talked earlier on a little bit about Iceland, didn't we? And I know Iceland has made itself a very important place where internet sites cannot be taken down from. So, in other words, a centre of free speech. Excuse me. And as part of that, one of the biggest supporters of Assange and WikiLeaks has been the former ambassador of Uzbekistan, the author, the guy who basically lost his career because he refused to support torture that was going on in Uzbekistan, and the Foreign Office sacked him as a result. And his name is Craig Murray. Well, this week, Martin, he's been charged with contempt of court for his blogging around the case of Alex Salmon, the former leader of the Scottish National Party, First Minister of Scotland, who was wrongly charged with sexual abuse of some of the women around him. And really, Craig Murray was exposing the amount of effort that Police Scotland put into this prosecution, which was colossal, although actually, as it turned out, there were no witnesses prepared to come forward.
Well, no witnesses were prepared to come forward and identify themselves, I understand. And, of course, the lawyer for Alex Salmon has also got himself into trouble because he was basically making what are essentially crude and offensive remarks about some of the accusers, and he's had to be, because that, and that was recorded, he was on a train, so that's another spin-off from the whole thing. And of course, Alex Salmond went to court and basically got off, and of course Craig Murray, being a solid supporter of Salmond, both of them Scottish nationalists, he's quite happy about the fact that Salmond's got off. And of course Salmond's case is that the whole thing was political because people didn't like his politics. And I'm pretty,
they did also, Martin, they didn't like his RT program either.
Well, no, exactly. In other words, Alex Salmond has taken fairly robustly anti-neoliberal, anti-mainstream views. And therefore, he's been made a target. That's what Salmond thinks.
So why would Police Scotland pursue a case, presumably backed also, of course, by Nicola Sturgeon, Alex Salmond's successor, that had so little evidence?
Well, you'd have to ask them that. And what Craig Murray argues, and I think he's probably right, is that the establishment in this country manipulates the courts. We can see that clearly in the case of Assange, who hasn't committed any crime in English law, and yet is being held in solitary confinement in a high security prison, even though he's not been charged with anything under British law.
I mean, some people say that if Assange is extradited, that's the end of the rule of law in Britain. Are they justified?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that he's in prison at all suggests that there is no rule of law. There is no basis I can see in British law for this guy to be held. He hasn't committed any offences in Britain, and the offences he's accused of in the US are political offences. He's being accused of espionage against the US, but he's not a US citizen. So how can he be?
He's an Australian citizen.
Well, indeed. So therefore, the Espionage Act is directed at US citizens who betray their country. And it was used politically when it was first brought in the First World War to send Eugene V. Debs to prison, who was the senator, socialist senator who opposed World War One, and he was sent.
Anyway, the interesting thing about this prosecution of Craig Murray for contempt of court is that it's taken place after the trial of Alex Salmond. Well, contempt of court charges, almost, I've never heard of something taking place after a case. It's almost always when somebody says something that they believe could prejudice a trial, the police are straight onto it and the person is charged with contempt of court whilst the trial is going on. But in this case, they seem to have waited until after the trial's finished.
Well, yes, and therefore another irregularity. Why are they not following the usual procedure? And I think what Craig Murray would point out is this ties Craig Murray up. He's going to have to defend himself. He's going to need to find money. And this is why they do it. They're harassing him, basically, because of his political views and the support he's tried to give to Julian Assange, who's clearly a political prisoner.
Let's have a look now at the banning in Germany of Hezbollah, because this seems to me quite an important and interesting, hardly talked about in the British press at all. I just picked it up on a World Service bulletin. But Hezbollah is actually quite, it's the most popular political movement, I believe, in Lebanon. And whilst this is all going on, there are lots of protests going on in Beirut and Lebanon, which threaten to possibly bring the government down. So this does look as if there may be a kind of regime change operation in the background here, since Germany is banning the main political movement in Lebanon, and also, of course, it is also an armed movement too. And also, you've got these protests going on too, simultaneously.
Well, I think that the Israelis, who are probably behind this manoeuvre in Germany, with the support of the Americans, of course, and no doubt the British humming and hawing in the corner, they want a war with Iran. That's what they've been saying all along. And that's what people need to realise. They want a war with Iran. And the question the ordinary people who are listening to this in this country have got to decide, do you want a war with Iran? Because that's what they want.
But isn't Hezbollah, although it's very popular, isn't it a terrorist organisation?
Well, isn't the people trying to overthrow the government of a democratically elected government of Syria, are they a terrorist organisation? Oh, no, they're freedom fighters. Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. it represents a substantial section of opinion, the Shia, who are the poorer section of the community and tend to live in the south of the country, which abuts Israel. They are part of the government. And the attempts to criminalize them like this are definitely a straw in the wind that we're going to possibly have an Israeli invasion of Lebanon and a strike on Iran, which will lead to a major escalation. I mean, a very interesting article by Scott Ritter on RT. He's pointing out that for Trump, if he can get some kind of war with Iran going, the oil price will shoot up and the US shale oil industry will be protected, 10 million jobs protected in the US, and it helps him get re-elected. So in actual fact, there's quite a lot of pressure on Trump, which is why he tweeted the other day that they were going to shoot down Iranian speedboats, because that actually had an effect on the oil market. That tweet pushed the oil price of oil up a bit, which of course is a key goal for Trump. And one way to do that would be to go along with the Israeli idea of let's have a war with Iran. But whether Boris Johnson thinks that's a good idea, we'll have to find out. He'll just be told anyway, because that's what sovereignty means in not 2020 Britain. We get told what's going to happen after everybody else has decided.
And a bit news out this week on signsofthetimes.net, SOT.net, an emergency response exercise in Swindon took place 4 days before the Skripal Salisbury incident 2 years ago. So that, Martin, does look as if, I mean, some of the same personnel that were involved in this Swindon exercise were then active the next 4 days later down in Salisbury dealing with the real Novichok attack, supposedly a real Novichok attack anyway. And there were all sorts of interesting things to do with that attack, not least of which is that the Royal Air Force's number one medic turned out to be the first person, senior person on the scene. Also that the first actual person on the scene was a off-duty detective for Wiltshire Constabulary. Also that the new chief constable of Wiltshire, that was his first day in the job, so he wasn't really necessarily all ready to deal with that whole situation. Lots of different anomalies. Another one that the senior guy at the Salisbury District Hospital said they didn't have any cases of dealing with
that was in the Times, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He wrote at the time saying there's no evidence that anybody has been admitted to this hospital suffering from nerve gas poisoning. That's on the record.
So, I mean, this whole idea of having an exercise 4 days before with some of the same people involved, the emergency response team, could just be coincidence, though, couldn't it?
Well, it could, but I think there's a pattern of provocation by MI6, basically. And Skripal was involved in the Steele dossier, which was, you know, all about Trump peeing on beds in Moscow and so on. And that's probably why he was, targeted, if he was targeted, but not by the Russians. And, of course, Berezovsky, who is Putin's big political enemy, he supposedly committed suicide in Surrey some years ago, but the coroner refused to sign it off as suicide. Now, you'd have thought that the Western press would be going, wow, Berezovsky, Putin's enemy, has been murdered by Putin. But, of course, they didn't say that because Berezovsky's daughter is pretty much convinced that he wasn't murdered by Putin. He was murdered by MI6. Now, the problem you've got with dealing with mainstream people in this country is if you say something like that, they say, well, MI6 doesn't murder people, so it couldn't possibly have been MI6 who carried out the attack on Skripal or anybody else. It must have been the Russians. But it's a circular argument. And in actual fact, the Russians roll their eyes, as well they should, because MI6 does kill people. It kills people in Britain. It kills people in Syria. The whole stuff about the Duma chemical weapons attack, we've now got people who are actually on the ground who carried out the investigation saying that the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons have been completely hijacked, and that the actual attacks, if they were carried out, were carried out with the use of by MI6 people working with Al-Qaeda. Now, that is actually the reality. MI6 has been working with Al-Qaeda since the 1980s. They've been working with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. They took people from Libya in the 1980s, trained them, infiltrated them into Afghanistan via Pakistan with the help of the ISI in Pakistan. This is all on the record.
Yeah, let me drag you back to the Swindon Brunel shopping centre in Swindon and the hazard response team exercise 4 days before Skripal. Are there any other cases where we've seen an exercise taking place just before where it looks as if that may have echoed what effectively is now known as a terrorist attack?
You usually find in these attacks that there is an exercise going on which goes live or doesn't go live. So on the day of the attacks in 9/11, they were carrying out an exercise of planes crashing into buildings. You couldn't make it up, could you? Nevertheless, they came out and said, who could have thought that planes would crash into buildings? Well, you could, because you were carrying out an exercise of doing just that.
The funny thing, of course, is that you were with the 7/7 London bombings, we had Peter Powers,
Peter Powers exercise. That's right, yeah.
With the coronavirus, we had an exercise with Bill Gates, Event 201, which predicted the possible death of 60 million people or so.
Yes, and the participant in Bill Gates's exercise was the CIA. Now, it's quite clear, coming back round the houses, that the US are going to try and blame, that the Australians are well out of the traps on this, are going to try and blame the Chinese for either accidentally or, more strongly, deliberately creating the coronavirus. But the Chinese have already got their answers in place for that. They pointed out about the military games, which they think probably was... The reason why they haven't pushed this is because they're trying to negotiate with the Americans. Yeah, we don't really want to go into what really happened here. You don't want us to. We don't want to. Let's just try and work together to resolve the problems. But if we're going to go down the road of pointing fingers, then we're going to start pointing fingers. And it looks to me, I think the means, motive and opportunity are all on the side of the US deep state. The same deep state that Donald Trump pointed out on the day of 9/11, those buildings must have been bombed. He's right. They must have been bombed.
You're talking really here about the Anglo-Zionist Empire. It's an alliance between Israel...
Yeah, whatever Britain, you want to call it, yeah.
An alliance between Britain, the United States and Israel. Who do you think are the key partners there? Who's calling the shots, if any?
Well, obviously the US are the senior partners in one sense because they're the biggest. But on the other hand, if you think about it, the Israelis, have given that they're a country the size of Wales, are punching way above their weight in that situation. And they, you know, they clearly have far more power than you would expect.
Where do they get that power from, though?
Sorry? Every year, for example, the US government gives the Israeli government $3.8 billion. They just give it to them every year. And nobody else gets that sort of money. And they can't afford to personal protection equipment for frontline health workers. They've got no money for unemployment benefits. But $3.8 billion a year goes directly to the Israeli government. Because basically they've got control fraud. I mean, you know, nobody in mainstream US politics is allowed to criticise Israel at all.
The same may be soon be true in the British Labour Party because the anti-Israeli government, pro-Palestinian faction has been roundly gotten rid of. Now Jeremy Corbyn has gone, Martin, surely.
Well, no, I think that battle's still going on. What's happened in the High Court here last week was that the attempt to make campaigning for boycott and disinvestment in Israel illegal has been overturned by the Supreme Court in Britain. You can campaign for it, and it's not to be, you can't be stopped. And of course, they had to go through appeals and everything to get to that point. And I think ultimately, Keir Starmer, who has a Jewish wife and claims that he is a Zionist, will have to confront the fact that the Israeli government interferes in our politics. And the Israeli government is in illegal occupation of the Golan Heights. They're about to annex the West Bank and the Jordan Valley, all of which is illegal in international law. And it should be a no-brainer for any Labour leader of any faction to condemn that because it's wrong.
I mean, how would you characterise the change that's taken place now Starmer's taken over from Corbyn, though?
Well, I think obviously what's happened is the party has tacked to the right, tactically. because of the loss of the election. Under first past the post, you can't just start a new party. You've got to work within the constraints that you've got. Now, Starmer has actually got quite a good head of wind behind him because he pulled in quite a lot of critical left-wing support. I mean, a few years ago, he wouldn't have had a chance, but he did get a chance because he basically tacked in their direction. I think that he's got a lot of pressure on him now. He's got to, he's got to be seen to be dealing with Boris, and B, what he's then got to do, he's got to be seen to be absolutely fair in dealing with all this anti-Semitism stuff, which means that people who make frivolous or malicious allegations, they must be punished. That's got to be the way. If we're going to take anti-Semitism seriously, and I think we should, that means people who make frivolous or politically motivated allegations or who support the frankly fascist policies of the current Israeli government, they need to be dealt with firmly.
But hang on a minute, because is Starmer even going to deal with those members of staff that were actively trying to stop Jeremy Corbyn getting elected?
Well, what he's trying to do is have another report into the first report so he can work out what he's going to say to try and keep everybody on side. He's not shown his hand yet. But of course, if he does decide to continue the war on the pro-Palestinian faction, if we can call them that, then there will be pushback. There will be. And if he wants that, that's what he'll get.
Also, though, of course, there's a lot of criticism of him when he was director of public prosecutions, being involved in the Assange case. Also, Ian Tomlinson, the guy at the G20 in London, who was very seriously injured by the police, by torture, MI5, stopping prosecution of MI5 and MI6 for torture, and also the charges against Jimmy Savile. He quashed those, which were brought by Surrey police. So the evidence was there. Savile was still alive. Starmer stopped the prosecution.
Well, I think if you were to say, is Starmer a safe pair of hands from the establishment's point of view, the answer has to be yes. He's gone out of his way to flag up that he's no threat to them. Whether he's any use to us is another matter. But of course, you can't always get what you want. And Starmer is the man with the ball, and he's got to decide what he's going to do with it. But of course, if he makes the wrong decisions, then the consequences will flow.
Well, let's just hope he doesn't drop it. Anyway, we also want to have a look now, Martin. I thought to look at this. It's just literally end of last week it came out. It's called Planet of the Humans, and it's by Michael Moore. He's the executive producer. But I thought we'd have a listen to a clip of it now, this film which has come out on YouTube. It's there for, I think, another 2.5 weeks for people to watch for free. And it's really about the hijacking of the green energy movement and the environmental movement. So let's have a listen to a clip from that now, which talks about some of the finances involved in green energy. I mean, just as a sort of one of the most important take-homes from the film is that we think of green energy as being things like solar power and wind power, whereas what he shows in the films is that this solar power and wind power, much of it is just not, doesn't last very long. I mean, they need to be replaced, these solar panels and these wind farms, but most importantly, they only represent a tiny fraction of what is now called green energy. One of the biggest and most important parts of green energy is what they call wood chips, which actually ends up being basically wood-fired power stations. And many environmentalists don't seem to have realised that the new fuel for the future is about destruction of forests and rainforests to fuel these new biomass plants. But anyway, let's have a listen to a clip from that new film, and it's called Planet of the Humans.
My guest tonight is on a global crusade.
On a global crusade for what?
Commit to divesting from fossil fuels. We can't justify investing our money in companies that are basically running Genesis backward.
So when you divest from fossil fuels and invest in green funds, what are you investing in? I took a deep dive into Securities and Exchange Commission filings to find out. For instance, in the Green Century funds, recommended by 350.org and Bill McKibben, I found less than 1% solar and wind and 99% things like mining, oil and gas infrastructure companies, including a tar sands exploiter, McDonald's, one of the companies driving meat consumption across the planet, Archer Daniels Midland, one of the world's largest producers of biofuel, Coca-Cola, the largest creator of plastic pollution on Earth, logging and paper companies, including one that brags about biomass burning, and banks. Lots of banks. Including BlackRock, the largest financer of deforestation on Earth.
The business that they're engaged in is actually destroying our life support system.
The Sierra Club also partners with a green fund called Aspiration. Aspiration also includes dozens of companies profiting from the destruction of the planet, including Chevron, ExxonMobil, Chesapeake Energy.
In order to maximize the production potential of the well, the shale formation will be hydraulically fractured.
The Russian gas giant Gazprom.
Gazprom owns the world's largest explored gas reserves, 36 trillion cubic meters.
And in perhaps the most bizarre twist of all, the Sierra Club's Green Fund's biggest holding is Enviva, the world's largest consumer of forests to be incinerated in green energy biomass plants. Of course, one investment option is a green fund run by Bill McKibben's buddy, David Blood. And who was the chairman of this fund? Someone familiar.
Use capitalism that gives incentives for people to do their best.
Al Gore and David Blood partnered to form a company called Blood and Gore. No, scratch that. Generation Investment Management. And within this fund, Blood and Gore designated a special investment category targeting $650 million of biomass and biofuels. Funny thing was, they partnered before Al Gore's film came out. Was that movie just about climate change or something else? You might ask yourself, how could men destroy what remains of nature to enrich themselves? Well, that's why they're billionaires and you're not. The takeover of the environmental movement by capitalism is now complete. Environmentalists are no longer resisting those with the profit motive, but collaborating with them. The Nature Conservancy is now the Logging Conservancy.
We will capture the most important pieces biologically, and there will be another large block sold to timber investment groups.
The Union of Concerned Scientists has become the Union of Concerned Salesmen, having taken millions not for science, but to create markets for electric cars. The Sierra Club sells electric cars and solar panels right from their website.
The best thing about Sungevity is that they make it easy for you. All that you have to do is to say yes.
The New York Times partners with ExxonMobil to bring you the good news about biofuels.
Algae-derived fuel could help us meet growing demand.
Treehugger.com, which claims to be the largest single source of environmental news, was founded and funded by Georgia Pacific, a logging company. In fact, they are neighbors. Georgia Pacific is owned by our friends the Koch brothers, who are likely the largest recipient of green energy biomass subsidies in the United States.
So that's Jeff Gibbs there. He's an environmentalist working with Michael Moore as executive producer on this new film, Martin. Really does paint rather a bleak picture of the environmental movement as having been rather sophisticated manner, rather cleverly hijacked.
Well, it's been going on for years, hasn't it? I mean, it's called greenwash. They claim to be green. Basically what they're doing there is exposing these ethical funds, green funds you can invest in, which basically are invested in all of the stuff they're talking about, which is about as green as you can imagine. I mean, of the biofuel stuff, that's been being pushed for years. And of course, in developing countries, you need land to grow food for people. If you turn it over to biofuel, you then drive people off the land and they end up in the favelas and so on.
Right. I mean, one of the things Brazil. Talked about in the film is the way that vast areas of Brazil have been turned over to sugarcane.
That's right. Monoculture.
Mass evictions at gunpoint of indigenous people from the country.
So what you really need, the problem with mainstream green thinking, and of course, you've got a big spectrum there. There's more radical greens, and there's more, you know, people who claim to be greens who are basically CEOs of major companies and hedge funds. But you've got to challenge the basic property rights of capitalist society. In Brazil, they need a land reform. They need ordinary people to be able to grow food on the best land in the country. It shouldn't be turned over to soybean production, biofuels, sugar, or any of that. And that requires a revolution. There was a revolution in places like South Korea after the Korean War, in Japan after the defeat by the Americans. There was a land reform. Ladayinsky, who used to be the major person who was responsible for land reform policy in the US, was eventually pushed out, Wolf Ladayinsky. But of course, ultimately, that's the solution for A, third world poverty, and B, to get a green economy. You've got to have a land reform revolution in the developing world. And of course, things like biomass, which basically use the best land to grow stuff to be used in power stations, that is not the way to go. It's the exact opposite.
How do you think it's been that so many environmentalists and people from the green movement have been dragged along with this? It seems to me that there just seems to have been a very clever PR campaign with things like wind farms and solar panels. One great big project he talks about in the film, Planet of the Humans, opening in the United States, opened by Arnold Schwarzenegger. He then goes to have a look at this plant to see that it's all falling apart. Basically, it still just about works, but there's no maintenance going on. A lot of the solar panels and the reflectors are broken. You know, that some of them are just lying there on the ground doing nothing. So it looks as if there's been a big attempt to make everyone get very excited about the idea of solar and wind power. In other words, not actually using any kind of fossil fuels or biomass, but this is covering up something much, much deeper, which is just a shift away from dependency on oil, really.
Well, I mean, the hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. 30 years ago, green ideas were marginal, and people who professed them were regarded as cranks. Gradually, they've come more into the mainstream, which has been good in a way. But of course, what happens then is that the mainstream basically recuperates what you're presenting. And who isn't green these days? Everybody's green. Donald Trump's green. We're all green. And of course, what it really means is we want to carry on doing what we've always been doing, but we want to pretend we're not doing it. That's been going on forever.
One of the things we have to cope with here in Bristol is this so-called green idea of burning our waste, including plastic waste, in incinerators in Avonmouth. In the film, it points out that many of these waste-burning plants, rubbish-burning factories, actually, they use a lot of natural gas. And also, the coal-fired power stations that have been closed down have simply been replaced by natural gas, which, again, is a fossil fuel.
Yeah, well, ultimately, I would argue that what you need to do if you're going to reduce your pressure on the planet through carbon footprints or whatever it is you've got to go for energy efficiency and, of course, in the developing world, land reform, so that people can actually grow their own food and not end up in megacities with coronavirus spreading and other diseases and all the rest of it. But that requires, ultimately, huge changes in the way society is organized. And what we've got here is a lot, basically business as usual, pretending to be something else.
Okay, so I'll put a link up to that on our show page. It's Jeff Gibbs and Michael Moore's new film called Planet of the Humans. It's about an hour and a half long, And absolutely, I found it absolutely riveting because it shattered some of my illusions. And that's what it does, what it says on the tin. And also the other thing I quite like about it, Martin, is the way that there are lots of experts appear in the film, but they're not necessarily the ones you're used to seeing on TV. He's really found some fascinating people who are very good on this subject, anthropologists, etc., at various universities around the US, and one or two geeks who just happen to be very good at understand the way things work. But anyway, our final item tonight is we're going back to look at the Nazi war criminal Martin Bormann, who was tried in absentia at the Nuremberg trials. Lots of question marks about what happened to him, whether or not his body was discovered in 1972, a month after there was a revelation from Stuart Stephen, who is a Bristol-based Western Daily Press journalist working at the Daily Express, that Bormann had been photographed and discovered in Buenos Aires in Switzerland. Now, this just wasn't any old war criminal. Martin Bormann was one of the key people in charge of the Holocaust, the Final Solution. He organized something called the Wannsee Conference, which was where Adolf Eichmann and the rest signed off the whole idea of having a silent, at least it wasn't to be talked about on open telephone lines, extermination of Jews in Nazi Germany. And Bormann was most importantly Hitler's private secretary. And just like some other allied leaders, Adolf Hitler didn't give written orders. He gave verbal spoken orders, which Bormann then transcribed, interpreted, and those were then passed on to the army. So Bormann was in a very powerful and important role. But what he'd like to look at tonight is, or today, whenever you're listening to this, is how Bormann rose to power. And this is from the series Hitler's Henchmen.
In May 1941, Bormann took over from Rudolf Hess as head of the party chancellery and effectively as Hitler's deputy. 2 years later, Bormann was given, in his eyes, an even more prestigious role, Hitler's official secretary. He controlled almost every aspect of the dictator's working life, from screening his appointments to handling documents that went across his desk. Now at the top of his game, within the competing factions vying for the Führer's attentions, Bormann occupied a prime position, deputy and secretary. He had become Hitler's shadow. It was a role that made him extremely unpopular. His proximity to Hitler made him some dangerous enemies. They included Hermann Göring, who had always seen himself as Hitler's successor. Göring despised Bormann as a lower-class thug, but as long as Bormann remained Hitler's favorite, there was nothing he could do about it. Meanwhile, Bormann reveled in Göring's discomfort. But it was his role in the murder of millions of Jews that made Martin Bormann one of the Nazis' most wanted war criminals. He became one of the most enthusiastic supporters of what would be known as the Final Solution, Hitler's policy of mass extermination. Initially, the Führer's conquering armies in the east were followed by Einsatzgruppen, brutal gangs of murderers who summarily executed thousands of Jews and undesirables. The problem the Nazis faced was by conquering so much extra land, they had acquired 4 million unwanted Jews. They needed a solution on an industrial scale. Bormann was the project go-between. making sure the Führer's name remained clean. He was the faithful manager and fixer for his idol. From 1942 onwards, Jews, Gypsies, and other groups from all across Europe were transported to specially constructed camps. There, they were ruthlessly worked to death or gassed in one of the most gruesomely efficient genocides of all time. Bormann would spend much of his time working with Gestapo and SS chief Heinrich Himmler. They would liaise directly over the progress of the final solution. Bormann would pore over Himmler's reports as the horrifying numbers mounted. On one occasion, Himmler used the word extermination instead of the code word resettled on an open phone line to describe the death of 40,000 Jews in Poland. Bormann was furious at the indiscretion. In future, all such reports were to be made through SS couriers or radio. There would be no more phone calls. But what Bormann didn't realize was that thanks to the cracking of the German Enigma codes, the Allies were already intercepting Nazi radio traffic and building their dossier on Martin Bormann. His role at the heart of Hitler's terror machine was well documented.
Well documented, but not really very well known, Martin. I think the main take home from a lot of this is looking at comparisons between the Second World War and now, but also I think it's fascinating that it was a Bristol journalist, Stuart Stephen, working at the Western Daily Press, after he got a job up at the Daily Express, that exposed much of this and even travelled to South America working with Ladislas Farrago and got this infamous photo, which I'll be putting up on our show page this week, .org.uk, of Martin Bormann in Buenos Aires in 1972.
Well, Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which came out in the 1980s, is very informative about all of this. And, of course, the book Op JB by Creighton Davis, because Bormann basically was a double agent working with the British and was removed by a British team from Berlin at the end of the war, and then via Britain was sent to Argentina. That's what the book seems to suggest. And of course, that there was actually a wholesale incorporation of the fascist intelligence structure into NATO in the 1940s. And it was going on during the war. Bormann was in communication with Morton, who was Churchill's advisor, during the war via Ian Fleming, who obviously ultimately wrote the books about James Bond, and Op JB was Operation James Bond was originally the code name for the operation of bringing Bormann out.
I think it's interesting the way that Op JB seems to be, as you were talking about there, involving John Ainsworth Davis, who was the operational commander, and Ian Fleming, who oversaw the operation and also went to Berlin at the end of the war. At that, Fleming, through his Bond novels, and one could also say his Bond films, because he was alive when some of them were still being made, was doing his best to give us an idea of some of the shenanigans going on behind the scenes. For example, one of the films, You Only Live Twice, is about an independent force in the world trying to ferment a war between the Soviet Union and NATO in order to basically be rulers of the world in the ashes of a potential nuclear holocaust.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, those the James Bond novels and films are fantasy, but nevertheless, Fleming was involved as an intelligence officer in these operations. There's a letter from him to Ainsworth Davis in the book where he says, well, after we're all dead, you can tell everybody the truth about what actually happened. And there are letters there from Churchill and from Mountbatten. In other words, I don't think it's really disputable that the Western Intelligence Services, the OAS, which became the CIA, MI6, collaborated with serious Nazi war criminals, both during and after the war, because they've got a long-term goal.
But what is the implications? That's what I was going to say. What's the implications for today of all this?
Well, I think what we've got running the West is essentially an oligarchy aligned with an intelligence apparatus, which basically drew its inspiration from the 30s and 40s and that era, which is why we've got all of these very tricksy false flag terrorist operations, all the stuff about weapons of mass destruction. That's definitely just a narrative. Nuclear weapons are nuclear weapons. Weapons of mass destruction can be anything you like. And of course, anybody can have weapons of mass destruction. So the whole idea of people having them, and we've got them, we've got biological weapons, but we're actually accusing the Russians of having them. We're accusing Al-Qaeda of
Hang on a minute, Marshall, because this week Putin has said that if there's a missile strike against the Russians, that he will treat it as if it was a nuclear strike. This is by the Americans, presumably. Yeah.
The Russian strategic doctrine has always been, we're not going to use these things, but if you attack us, then we're going to nuke you. The Western strategic doctrine is, we're not going to say we won't use nuclear weapons first. And in actual fact, we want to keep our opponents on their toes. So they openly discuss the possibility of a first strike taking out the leadership in Russia and China. They did a war game of that the other week.
Do you think
the Daily Express?
Do you think the advent of the pandemic makes that any more or less likely or not?
I think we're obviously all in the dark here about what's really going on. We've only got limited information. But my estimation of this, they are definitely playing to use the pandemic as a means to start both physical and economic war with China. And whether they did it or not, that's what they're going to do. They are disaster capitalists. If it's just an accidental outbreak, they're going to exploit it to try and get regime change in Venezuela and in Iran. That is definitely what's happening. And because they're exploiting it so ruthlessly, I generally tend to the opinion that it's quite likely that they started it. And I think people say, well, they wouldn't do stuff like that. I say, phooey. They do stuff like that. They drench the whole of Vietnam in Agent Orange, killing millions of people and causing all sorts of problems even right up to today. But it's the enemies who are going to use these terrible weapons, not us. During the first Gulf War, they went on about how Saddam Hussein had these terrible fuel-air explosives, which could devastate a whole 10-kilometre area and everyone was burned to a crisp. But of course, it turned out that it wasn't Saddam who had fuel-air explosives. It was them. And of course, what they do is they project onto their fantasy enemies all of the things that they themselves are doing. Yeah. So if you listen to what they say, you can be pretty certain that they are the ones behind this, because what they're accusing other people of doing, they do.
Let's finish on some good news. The BBC has halted 450 job losses to help with its coronavirus coverage. This is in the Journalist magazine. BBC News has suspended plans to cut 450 jobs amid the demands for covering the coronavirus pandemic. Job losses were announced in January as part of an £80 million cost-cutting plan. Programmes that were due to be hit included BBC Two's Newsnight and BBC Radio 5 Live. A job cut delay came shortly after the BBC said it was postponing the end of the free TV licence scheme for all over 75s, because it was important that everyone should be able to access news during the health crisis. So, at least some people have not lost their jobs, essential workers like journalists carrying on. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest there. That was old Labour Oxford economist, also known as Irish Republican Labour activist, Martin Summers. Also, great deal of thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and the picture of Martin Bormann in 1972. And you can compare the picture to 1944 on our website, our comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You also find me on Twitter, tweeting away at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM week. I'll be back next week with some more insight into that election that never was, in a city with an unelected mayor next Friday. Do please join us for the BCFM Emergency Scheduled Dialect Politics Show online on Friday or on FM at 10 p.m. on Monday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.